They might talk about humor, music, film, books, football and box sets, exercise and maybe even food. Trivia and sport, politics and health, sometimes well-being too. On the Life with Brian. On the Life with Brian.
Hello and welcome to Life with Brian. Mark here, and I'm joined as ever by Matthew Crist. How are you, Matthew?
Hello, Mark. I'm very well, thank you.
And of course, I've got Celtic and Manchester United legend, who also played a bit for Motherwell, Aston Villa in his younger days, and Scotland. Of course, it's Brian McClare. Brian, how are you?
I'm good, now that I've sorted out the few technical gremlins. Unfortunately, you can now see me and you can now hear me, and I can see and hear all of you. So it's all downhill from here.
And somebody else we can see and hear on the show is our guest this week, and it's former Celtic, Hearts and Scotland winger and Chockey's good pal, John Colquhoun. Thanks for coming along, John. How's things?
Things are okay. And for all of you listeners, or regular listeners, they would like to know that the fact that Brian was supposed to be the thinking man's footballer, and the technical glitches he alluded to just there, was that he'd forgotten to plug his microphone in. So it's not a very good start for a thinking man's footballer, I would suggest.
No, it's a little peek behind the curtain there for the listeners.
You can always align your friends to give it to you absolutely straight. You know, no messing around, no dressing it up. There you go. Just you have it like that, which is perfect because that's what true friends are for. They tell you the absolute truth at all times. So, yes, I'm guilty of idiocy.
Brian, should we crack on then? What's been on your mind since the last episode?
Well, if you're thinking about my particular musings, I've got this particular musing that I would wondered about your potential experiences of this. Have you ever been down in the tube station at midnight?
Oh.
Well, I would probably say I have.
It must be a memorable thing.
I have actually been in the tube station at midnight because I once missed my tube back when I worked for a magazine in London. This dates when it was. Chris Evans was there, a couple of the Spice Girls.
I think we'll say that. I think we'll log off now, John.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Who was it? Donna Air, the ex MTV DJ or VJ.
In the tube station?
Isla Fisher. Well, no, funnily enough, they weren't. They were at this party, but I'd had a few too many scoops and, every intention of getting the last train back. Of course, one thing led to the other, and I never made the train back. But I still headed to the tube station in the hope that, you know, there was going to be a train there. And there wasn't, so I thought, well, I think I have 4 hours to kill till the first morning train. So I quite literally bedded down for the night. I took my jacket off and I put it under my head and I slept on the station. But of course, within an hour or so, I had the good people of a London charity come along and start offering me food, you know, soup and bread rolls and blankets. And they thought I was a genuine homeless person. I was trying desperately to explain that I wasn't, and that I'd been out drinking with Chris Evans and the Spice Girls. And of course, that made them think I was more and more crazy. And then some of these unfortunate homeless guys came along and started asking me why I was there and what I was doing. And again, I said, I've just been out with Chris Evans and Isla Fisher from Home and Away, as she was then. And then they were like, oh, yeah, me too, mate. Yeah, I used to be in the royal family and now I'm sleeping on the train station. You know, so no one believed me. But it was quite an entertaining experience, actually. I hadn't actually thought of it in the musical sense. So, I most definitely have been down the tube station at midnight and 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning until that first milk train turned up. So, I can quite categorically say yes.
Are you, Mark?
No, that's as all, that, probably. I don't know. Most of my nights out that would involve being in the tube station at midnight have probably end up with me not really remembering why I was there. And but you know, I'm interested, Matthew. Did you actually take the soup that was offered to you?
Certainly.
I think
Brian could probably answer that question.
Absolutely, certainly.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I took one.
He was on his way as well.
I took it and I took a few extra and took them home and put them in the freezer. they were having none of it. They were adamant that I was. It wasn't soup. It was this was a long time ago. I assume they still do it. But what they do is they go around to restaurants and get any kind of leftover food and what have you, and they parcel it up and then they give it to the unfortunate people that are sleeping rough. So I had like a Chinese meal or an Indian curry or something, and it was probably the best meal I'd had all week. But it was. I'd say it dates it. I think it was definitely sort of mid late 90s, because just thinking about the guest list of people who were there. It was back in my youth. Obviously, you'd never find me doing something like that these days, Brian, would you? No. Sleeping on park benches and taking food from people.
No. Before we go to join them, I actually spent time in the tube station at midnight before the song came out. I think it came out in October 79. And in the summer, either the spring or maybe Easter or the summer of that year, I was 15 on trial at Arsenal. And we were staying, they put us up in a hotel at Finsbury Park. And my the room that they gave me was actually outside the main hotel, like a little annex room, that its own front door. And I decided in my wisdom then to go to the tube station and go to Piccadilly Circus and Soho. So as a 15-year-old, I'm wandering around Soho, not known at all, totally naive wee boy from Scotland, that it could have been a wee bit dodgy. Spent a nice time wandering around, looking at lights, looking at lots of different things. And then I got tube back, probably late on again then. I went back, got up the next day, went to training, and I did the same thing the following night. And then nobody was any the wiser. Fortunately, child welfare has moved on a little bit since those days. But yeah,
having worked in London a lot of years ago, the thing with the tube was it always used to stop at about half 11. So the irony of the down in the tube station at midnight thing, I mean, I doubt very many people have, because until the night service opened, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, whenever it was, I mean, you could never get a tube. You had that dilemma. That's why I ended up sleeping on the streets, because you had that dilemma of last orders or the last train, from what I remember. I mean, we are going back a long way, obviously.
And what's the relevance for you, John?
I thought that story was going to start. It was a great story, Brian. I thought it was going to be really good when you said I was on trial. I thought you were going to say at the Old Bailey, which would be really impressive at 15 years old. And I can only imagine what crimes you would have committed to be on trial at the Old Bailey. And then for everybody, just about everybody else I know or have ever known, as a 15-year-old who's told a story about going to Soho on a clandestine trip to say they were just looking at the lights, I would call them the biggest liar I'd ever met, or think it was a euphemism for something. But I actually believe it 100%. I've got no interest in stories about the tube. I spent a lot of time working down in London and was in the tube station late of the midnight on a lot of occasions for a variety of reasons. But nothing really interesting happened. I don't have a Chris Evans or an Isle of St. Clair story. But I used to love it. I just love travel and the cosmopolitan nature of London. I used to love the tube and all kind of life's flotsam and jetsam in the tubes at that time of night when they're making their way home, and when all kind of weirdos sleeping on benches after having crashed from a dodgy showbiz party, Yeah, I mean, I think that's more embarrassing story than you wondering about Soho, Mr. McClure.
Yeah, but you weren't 15, were you? You were like you're more of an immature, whatever it is.
Maybe we're always out 15.
Surely the reason for this down in the tube station at midnight, is it not something to do with once it's in your head, you kind of get that song out?
Absolutely.
Well, it's working on me right now.
No, I think more like to John, it is all the time, the same thing for ages. It was a joke.
Yeah.
It would be, how you doing, John? A distant echo. Oh, no.
That is one of the past. That was one from the past. Are we going to go on how we first met, Brian?
I think we should. Of course.
Yeah. Do you want to give your recollections?
I'll give my version of it.
Well, yeah.
So my version of it was, Brian was talking about himself being a naive and vulnerable young boy wandering about the streets of London. Well, I was a naive and vulnerable young football player who signed with his heroes, the famous Celtic. And I signed, and I was from a part-time team, a small team in Scotland called Stirling Albion, fantastic club. Who started me on my way, giving amazing foundations for what I managed to achieve in the game. And the manager looked after me, and he always said that if he could get me to Celtic, if he ever wanted me, he would move heaven and earth. So the club accepted the offer, and he did that. And so we went up on a Monday morning to sign. Signed, and Celtic were going away to play against Nottingham. So. And when I was insane, remember Prezi's office, Brian, yeah. And then the manager's office through the back, it was like the kind of the skankiest place you've ever seen. You mean this big, massive club? And so he signed in this room, and then the manager David Hayes said, "Would you like to come to Nottingham with us?" Now, obviously, I couldn't play based on two things: one, the UEFA regulations, and two, that I wasn't good enough at that time. But obviously, I was delighted to be asked to go, and of course said yes. So I had to go back and get clothes to go, because obviously this wasn't part of the plan. So Alex Smith drove me in his big, the manager Stirling Albion drove me in his big fancy Jaguar away there to Stirling when I came and back. So it took about an hour and a half. By the time I got back, all the players were on the bus. Your worst nightmare: this little kid from the sticks having to go on the bus with all his heroes. Danny McGrain, Paul McStay, Murdo McLeod. And so we did the obligatory photograph with a scarf above our head, and then had to go on the bus. And so it's intimidating at the best of times if you know people, but I didn't know a lot, and hardly knew anybody, didn't know any person on the bus. But what I did know is that a certain Brian McClure was kind of not dissimilar to me, because he was already then seen as a kind of alternative footballer. So I thought, and you always look for somebody that kind of has got sort of common values and goals and kind of similar age. So I'm actually looking for him on the bus. So I see him, I start to walk up, and there was a famous sketch at that time by Ben Elton about getting on a train, which was called double seat. You've got to get a double seat. But when you went on, when somebody got on a train, the person in the double seat would spread themselves out on the seat so that nobody could sit back beside them, like the bags and everyone would go beside them. So if you're walking up, you would see another seat and you would sit there. So I've seen Chalky, Brian McClure, I'm not right, I'm straight up to him, halfway up the bus, because the hierarchy of a football bus is kind of set. Everybody sits in a certain place, and there's a sort of seniority to it. So Brian's kind of half to the back, because he's kind of in with the bricks, but he's not one of the men by this time. So I'm making a beeline for him. Now, Ben Elton could have made a full sketch about Brian spreading himself out over these two seats. Honestly, he spread himself out. He could have got his two legs up and his two arms up at the same time, so I couldn't sit next to him. He would have done it, right? He's always got this backpack now. Well, he actually put a three-piece luggage set next to him, so I couldn't sit next to him. So anyway, so I was like kind of rather sheepish and just found my own seat and went and sat down, and one or two of the players came down to see me. None of those players was called Brian McClure. And then, so that was fine. Went down there, and it was a great trip. You mean Celtic played really well, got a great draw down there, and it was a great chance for me to get to know the players. And I can't remember at what point during that or the next few days that we kind of started to talk and clicked, and everything that I thought about Brian was true. And kind of from that time, a few days later, maybe a couple of weeks later, we bonded and have become firm friends, and Brian is without doubt one of our best friends in the world. And so we ended up, because we ended up messing about with Frank McGarvey and David Provins' game of Scrabble and messed it up, which they were absolutely raging about, because unknown to us, they were playing for money at Scrabble, right? And it wouldn't have been me, because I wouldn't have been Connors to do it, but he's knocked the board or something when they went down for dinner and messed it all up, and they came up raging. And I was like a schoolboy giggling in the background, you know what he'd done. And so we bonded after that. And I don't know, weeks or months later, I said, why did you do that on the bus? And he went, because I thought you were coming to steal my place. Simple as that. I thought you were coming to take my place in the team. So why would I show you any kind of love? And then he realised I was actually quite pissed, so I was never going to take his place. And I was going destined to play for Hearts and Sunderland and Millwall. He was going to play for Manchester United and break the George Best hoodoo of scoring 20 goals in a season in the English Premier League. So that's the story. That's my recollection, which is absolutely the true one.
Do you want to respond, Brian?
No, the reason was that exact reason. I had this thing at, it was all the way through the time at Celtic that David Hay not only signed strikers, because he did sign other players, but he seemed to sign strikers. And I was always the one that got left out of the team. And it seemed to be that, now that they've signed John, that he's, well, John was a striker then, although he went on to a wonderful career, really playing more on the flanks. And that would have been right. I didn't want to have be friendly with someone who I thought was going to be a competitor. And what had happened was we did go and play the game, but we were allowed to go out into Nottingham after the game.
Right.
And we were in this nightclub, and it became quite clear that John and I were in an environment that we weren't comfortable in. And then maybe a song came on, and one kind of track out of a load of pish disco music or something like that came on, and we were kind of, oh, that was, and it was linked through music, and all of a sudden, oh, you like, and then we struck up a conversation, first of all, about music. And once I'd recognised that, I thought I was being, I realised how childish and pathetic I'd been that this guy's like, he's come here and you need to have, I was like being petty. I was absolutely being petty. And then I thought, well, I can't shun the guy that out of all these other people who's got a great taste in music and also has got various other things in common. One, he knew how to play Scrabble properly, in that you're supposed to form words and how to try and manipulate triple word scores and things like that. The political aspect was very interesting. The reading and then also just the fact that John had his interest in life. Another thing that was a connection as well is that John and I shared the same football teams. We both supported Celtic, but we also both supported Manchester United. So there was a loads of connections there. But in the first instance, no, he's not. I'm not having this guy. He's like, but I didn't know anything about him because there was no opportunities to look up anyone, even to read falsehoods on your Wikipedia pages and like that. It was only the fact that he's another striker, and I was like, here we go, here's another one I've got here. And they were all good people and all that, but there wasn't a lot of common interests with the people that were my teammates, or our teammates as it were. So it was
And to be honest, Brian, you mean I could have actually accepted it initially, your disdain and instant dislike to me, if it'd been based on that dodgy moustache that I had when I came on the bus. Do you mean that's all you had to say? I didn't like you because how can you come on with a Mickey Pierce moustache? you just can't do that and expect to be taken seriously talking about the Clash and Iggy and all these superstar musicians to us, and have that dash.
I think it was magnificent, because the fact that you could grow such a healthy, strong moustache was a sign of, for me, that was another thing I was envious of. Not only is he coming to take my place, but what a fucking moustache he can grow as well. And he's got this curly hair and all that kind of thing. And I'm thinking, wow, this guy's got a few things going for him, you know. I'm like, nah, not having that, you know. He's defeated me in the hirsute stakes with his hair and his facial. It's only when you look back on it, isn't it? You know, it's like, well, was it or was it not? But you persisted with it for a long time, didn't you? So
I did. And I can always remember coming in after I shaved it off. And again, I'm not sure you walked straight past me because you never recognised me. I got a short haircut and I got rid of the moustache and I came in. And at that point, there was a man of the cloth who used to come in and do a few laps around Celtic Park before we trained, if you remember, Brian.
Yeah.
And I, for some reason, my station to train, to change was next to him, and I was getting changed and you walked in, because I was always in early, and you walked in and you said morning, father, and you just walked straight past me as though you're just a interloper in the dressing room, and I was looking at him and it was, it's me, Brian, it's me, it's your friend. And and then you realised and
it was your proper makeover.
I got your Rick Mayall smirk.
You got your proper makeover, though, wasn't it? That was a huge thing. You whip off the rat came off and your hair. I mean, it was like
a lot.
Yeah,
a lot. I went for it all in one day. You know, and the other interesting thing you said about there, Brian, was talking about you saw me as another striker coming in, and that was the kind of weird thing. I mean, I know this is not a football podcast per se. The weird thing was I went to Celtic as a striker. And I went there, and I don't know, and I've never had the chance to ask Davey Hay. From that day, I was never a striker, I was a winger. And they must have known I was a striker because the chief scout, John Kelman, came to watch me 27 times before they made the decision whether to spend £50,000 on me. So they must have known that I was a striker. And then I came to Celtic, and whether it was because there were so many good strikers at the club at the time, or whether it was because they thought, you're small and you look as though you would suit the number 7 on your shots, we'll make you into a winger. And that was kind of career defining for me, that going to Celtic in kind of more ways than one.
Okay, we thought that since these two former Celtic men go back a while, we'd see if they know each other so well that they can answer questions from each other's shoot and match profile interviews from the 1980s. So over to you, Matthew, and you're going to dish out three questions each for Brian and John, aren't you?
I am, yeah. Right, so we'll do these alternately, like a penalty shootout. And like you say, we've got three each. So John, seeing as you're our guest, we'll start with you first. And like I say, these are the questions that were asked to each of you during the 80s and shoot match, whatever the magazine was. So, John, who did Brian say was his favourite other sports star in his 1986 shoot interview?
1986. Give me a clue. It's not a footballer, is it?
No, not a footballer. I mean, the timing isn't necessarily relevant. I mean, he was obviously big in the 80s, but I mean,
Jack Nicklaus.
No. I mean, I didn't know. Was Jack Nicklaus a?
No, he's not.
Yeah, Brian, were you a fan of Jack Nicklaus, or was that just a random guess?
That was a random guess.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if I was to say the sport you're talking about was but if I was to say the sport was cricket, would that help you?
It wouldn't help me because I've never heard of any cricketers. No. I've got to go for Viv Richards.
Yeah, well, there you go. All right. Well, I gave you a clue, but you're right. Bang on. Yeah, you said Viv Richards was...
Why did you pluck Viv Richards out of the cricketers? Or...
Because I'm great.
Yeah, good at that, yeah.
What was it about Viv, Brian, that was... Were you just making it up like you do with most of your shooting matches?
No, you don't make up things. Sometimes you do things, but not. You're not going to use the great Vivian Richards as a joke. I've always loved cricket, and he for me was entertaining. You know, we were been chatting, John and I, recently about the entertainment and loving and being fans of football and things like that, and that we always wanted to watch, and we still do want to watch entertainment, whatever sport is it we like. Viv Richards was an entertainer. One of the things that I always find strange in all these things is when people like us choose individuals. Well, not so much about that, but your favourite other one is why they choose individual sports people as people they revere. Because I've always thought that it was the ones that were great, but wanted to be part of a team. So Viv Richards was great, but he loved being part of the team, and the team was important. But you know, just watching them play. I mean, they were great as a group for several years. Just wonderful to watch, and they played. They smiled all the time, didn't they? Which is, I mean, they just played with a spring and a smile. You know, they weren't. We weren't taking the piss when they were playing. They wanted to win tough and all that kind of thing. But they plenty of them seemed to enjoy it and laugh about that. And when they were out, they just went. They didn't. There was no arguing with it. You know, no argument about it. You know, whether it touched it or not touched it. You know, they walked. And I thought that was, you mean, even comparison to football at the time was that just because of the culture, we would argue black was white when it came to referees and linesmen and opponents, but they didn't. They just accepted it and walked off the field.
Yeah, true. Great team, great player. Yeah, couldn't agree more. So, Brian, your turn now. So we'll give you that one, John. Yeah, with a heavy clue, you did get Viv Richards, so that's 1-0 to you. So Brian's response now. So in his shoot or match interview, when you were both at Celtic, what did John say was his favourite article of clothing?
His favourite article of clothing?
Yeah. And he's quite specific in his answer.
Scarf.
No. And you know, you're not close either. I'll give you one more shot because I gave John...
Oh, is it a specific article of clothing?
Yeah. And he mentions a name. Let's just say that. I mean, I'll give you a clue. It was a T-shirt of some variety.
Could be Ralph Lauren, Armani, Chanel.
No, he says it's Ted Hawkins' T-shirt. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, John?
Yeah, Ted Hawkins was a singer, songwriter that did a little acoustic stuff on the boardwalk of Venice in Los Angeles. And I just loved him. He was just a brilliant singer-songwriter. We saw him a few times. The last time I saw him was at the Queen's Hall in Edinburgh, and he was just like a big 6'4" guy. He could fill a room, not with his size, but with his talent. And I love Ted Hawkins. Great few albums, and worth checking out if you haven't heard any of them.
Do you still have the T-shirt?
No, I don't, but I have a lot from that either, and I thought I would have had it. But I don't, but I have a lot of them. I found a lot of T-shirts from that era not long ago when I was looking up for some memorabilia that I gave away recently. And I found them in a... they were actually better packed away than my old strips from my playing days, all of these old t-shirts from the gigs that I would go to. And you kind of always, I was kind of always waiting for the song I liked the least, so I could go to the merch stand when it was the quietest, when the main band were on, to buy my merchandise. But no, I did love that t-shirt.
Okay, so I make that 1-0 to John. So back to you, John. And there's no specific year on this one, but I mean, we're talking mid-80s, obviously. Who did Brian say was his most famous friend outside of football?
Most famous friend.
I mean, I dare say he probably had a few.
Yeah, he would have had a few at that time. He was a big star then.
I mean, we're talking...
Was a musician?
I shouldn't be giving you too many clues, but I mean, he is a musician. And we're talking mid-80s here.
A Glasgow musician?
I couldn't be sure he's from Glasgow, but I mean, he's Scottish.
I don't know, so I'm going to go for... I'd like it to be Roddy Frame, but I don't think it is.
No, it's not. And, I can't really give you another shot. Well, it was Bobby Bluebell Hodgins.
I met him once.
So we're talking about one of your phony answers again here, are we?
Well, I spent all day with him. That was the which gave you to a project to work out, you know.
Yeah, well, it's all these years on, he's come back up in conversation. But yeah, that's who you said it was, Bobby Bluebell. So you don't keep in touch, seeing as you were such good mates, I take it.
I met him once.
So I was kind of going down the wrong way there. I was trying to work out from Brian's life who it was that he was actually friendly with, when it was actually just a random some Glasgow musician that he met in the street and went for a couple of beers with.
Yeah, well, Brian's quite well known for his slightly untrue answers to these. Yeah, well, I didn't want to say that, but you know, he has been known to admit that he's.
Did you say lies then?
Yeah,
I didn't. Yeah.
Oh, I'm saying, did you say lies, John?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, lies.
Or untruths. That one's not a lie, though, because...
Well, I spent all day with him. There might have been a beer involved. No, it couldn't have been. There was no beer involved. It was just, I spent all day with him in I think it was his flat as well.
I mean, I'm tempted to ask what the situation was that you spent the whole day with him in his flat, but you're not great mates, but...
Yeah, but that was because they were doing that new music newspaper, Me and the Hat. Me and the Hat.
In the Hat.
In the Hat, when we ended up getting the double page spread about.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw that. I saw that recently. Did you post that, Mark?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. So, you know.
Can you give these two a little tiny glimmer of something, and they're away all night on the internet looking for it.
But that's where we found it. That's where we found it.
Really embarrassing there that you don't want to come out, John. Don't mention it, right? Because if the next minute is like that, the fuck does that come? Where did you find that?
Well, you can't blame us. We found it on the internet, so someone must have put it on there. And more importantly, you must have given them the magazine, or if it still exists. But
I didn't give them. I wouldn't give them anything.
Well, right. Well, we're not taking the blame for that. We shared it.
It was bad enough at the time without it.
Okay.
Those two were Glasgow's version of Hoddle and Waddle.
Well, exactly. I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of looking at the pictures. I think you look fine. But
yeah, you haven't heard the single though.
Not yet. I'm waiting for that to come out. Right. So that's another miss there. So we're still 1-0. When asked if he had to seek a new job or profession, what did John say he would like to work in?
So alternative. An MP.
Oh, no. Well, he may well have done, but that wasn't his answer. So you've gone straight in there and you got it wrong. Can you remember, John?
I would say journalist.
Yep, that's what you said, journalist.
And that's what I stand by.
Any reason? I mean, some obviously just...
Yes, because I enjoyed writing as much as I enjoyed playing football.
And was it ever an option for you? I mean, did you...
Yes, I went into doing quite a lot of journalism when I was still playing. I used to do a column for a broadsheet called Scotland Sunday, did stuff for The Guardian. And it was really, really exciting and interesting. And I wrote every part of it myself. You know, we had some nice sub editors that would tidy it up for me, tidy my grammar, and put my commas in the right and wrong place. And but I really enjoyed that, and I still even to this day I really enjoy writing. And it is a passion of mine, and was back then. And yeah, I would have loved to make it as a journalist. Probably primarily at that time, probably either political journalist or a sports journalist. But then it kind of evolved into something that it wasn't, because my great heroes were Hugh McIlvany. You know, he's what Hugh McIlvany wrote some of his boxing stuff. I mean, the piece that Hugh McIlvany did about the 1970 World Cup final. You mean, and there's just nothing better than sitting reading a great piece on a great sporting event. But what happens now, it kind of has been overtaken, because everybody sees everything. Mm. So you see it before you get to read it, and it's really difficult to find anybody that's given the time by a newspaper, a media outlet, to write that kind of stuff. And but there is now, with the internet and the social media, there is some really great stuff going around, but you've got to work hard to find it. I still think there's some really good journalists going around, but they don't get the time to do the stuff that I really want to read. You know, when I saw a piece a couple of weeks ago on something that was interesting at the Masters, but it was like 800 words. I wanted 2,000 words of it. I wanted it expanded. And that was always, you know, I love reading. And it was always a passion of mine. So yeah, I would have loved to have been a journalist.
I mean, Brian said guest MP there. Was that a wild shot in the dark, or was politics something you would have?
Oh, it was definitely something I was interested in.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I mean, did you go?
I was going to do it. I was going to stand when I was playing. I was going to stand against Malcolm Rifkind, and we had with the Labour Party, we had everything in place for me to stand in Edinburgh South at one point. But it kind of, there was a variety of reasons why it kind of petered out. A few blocks to it. Probably my contract at Hearts was a big one. It was something that I was interested in when I was younger, and it's something that I thought I would go in then. But then we ended up getting devolution, and kind of the whole thing got a bit different and a bit messy. And so I kind of drifted away from that career option, to be honest.
Well, we're going to come back to politics later on, but who was Brian's favourite cartoon character, according to his Shoot interview?
It should be Dick Dastardly.
It should be. Is that your answer?
That's my answer.
No. Brian, can you remember who it was?
Danger Mouse?
No. I mean, again, with your question, whether your answers here, we're not sure whether these are genuine or not. But I mean, I can only go by what's written in the magazine in front of me. And you said Inspector Gadget.
Yeah, at the time it was Inspector Gadget.
Yeah. Any reason? Just was it his dress sense? Was it that the raincoat and the hat, or was it?
I think it was the gadgets, which is something that I've I don't think I've ever grown out of gadgets. It's just that idea that you could just, you know, go gadget legs, go gadget arms. It's something you allude to in the way you're playing football, you know. You know, you could just, like, you're having a wee bit of a problem against this defender, so you can just press a little bit of a button in your legs and then just take giant steps towards the goal and then fall over and miss it rather than you would normally miss it, you know. And that was I suppose sitting on the couch and you can just reach to the fridge, open the fridge and take out a slice of key lime pie that you just made.
Okay, well, the final question to you, John, to you, Brian, and it's the same question in reverse. Who was John's favourite cartoon character?
Favourite cartoon character? Yogi Bear.
Nope, another miss, I'm afraid. Foghorn Leghorn, apparently.
Foghorn Leghorn. Boy, I say boy.
Well, it's interesting because that's my son Liam's favourite cartoon character. And it is also, because I've just started reading his memoir, John Cooper Clarke's favourite.
Is that?
Yeah.
What?
He mentions.
I like that.
What was it, John, like about that. Foghorn? That was it just his style and his delivery?
Just his style. He's the man. Still is. No, not the man, but you know what I mean. you know what I mean. I just loved them. I love cartoons.
Was that from like childhood or from your days of training and going home and watching a lot of daytime television?
Well, there's a lot of cartoon characters I played with. but no, from just forever. I just love cartoons. I think they're great. A great escape.
Well, on that note, that's the final penalty, which was missed. So only one success there, and that was the first question. So that's 1-0 to you, John.
Just yeah, to be fair, Matthew, I should actually get an extra point because I got at least one of my own ones right as well.
Yeah, and of course we don't know whether Brian was giving genuine answers at the time, which he's openly admitted to.
Yeah, but there's still the answers, and I can remember them.
I think you sold him a dummy or two there, but either way, you didn't get one right anyway. So John wins either 1 or 2-0. But
why are you so smug about it?
I'm not. I'm just being the referee. I'm just.
You're not impartial.
Matthew, was I involved in a conversation a little while ago where he was admiring Viv Richards for his acceptance when he got bowled out and he just walked off accepting the decision of the referee?
Exactly.
And all of a sudden, because it's gone against him, wants to argue with the referee.
Well, I think that's why Brian obviously became a footballer, not a cricket player. So, so unlucky, Brian, you're out. Walk.
Well, if you'd have said you were the umpire, but you said you were the referee, referees were for arguing with, remonstrating with that's umpires.
True.
How would we get on with VAR, Brian? Would we have been over arguing with the television screen?
Having
a go at it.
I think that one of my main thing about it, John, is that you start off. So you and I started kicking a ball about probably as soon as we could walk, and maybe there was I saw a picture recently, and I must be months old. And I'm sitting in the garden and there's a ball there, right? So the ball was introduced into my life at that age, right? So I remember very, very early kicking a ball about and enjoying doing that and continued to do that, practice against the wall and then playing with a tennis ball at school and then going through and just playing. And all the kind of situations that you're playing in various different things, your street football, to your structured team football, you get potentially get better at it. So we got better at it because we practiced more, we practiced harder, and we learned and we worked at it. And along that kind of way, you get experienced at it and you experience in different situations. And when you play professional football, you get more and more and more and more. And it doesn't really matter what you're doing. You're saying the great example of wonderful journalism with Hugh McIlvany. He spent a lifetime to get to that point where he was writing those things. He did put his hours in, his 10,000 hours, if you want to say. And you get to things where, when I'm watching the television now, with football, and sometimes with other sports as well, but mainly with football, I think that I can see better than any of these ones that are watching. So if they can't see it with several different views, why can I make a better judgment on what's happening after one view of it? And you, I think, can do it as well. And all the other ones who've played at a good level for a long time, it's because we've had that experience of doing it and that kind of feeling. And reading, right, okay, the reading of it. So we could read the other players. We could read their opponents. We could read their teammates. We could get little signals from them. And when you're watching things, you know how people react to certain situations. So you're almost guaranteed that when a defender does something, he's guilty of it because of the way he behaves after. If he's not guilty, he behaves a completely different way. So you would end up, going mad about it, because it's like, well, you know, you're working your way down one side to play a great ball, and I get into the middle of the goals and put it in, and I'm deemed to be a toenail offside. That's preposterous to me. But one of the things I'm asking about, who draws the lines? Who checks that the lines are all the same in every single ground? Who checks is exactly the same calibration? That's what I'd be arguing about. I want to see your calibration certificate. Show me your calibration certificate, you know? We've watched and played football at the best time you could for me. And then people can say, ah, that's because you're old, that's all the other stuff. But it's not bringing any more joy to the game. That's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to bring more, make the game clearer, the rules about to make the game more attractive. With you're not allowed that free kick up the backside in the first couple of minutes that defenders used to do to us, and get up smiling at us, knowing thing. Well, the referee would be unusable to speak to them, never mind even consider giving them a yellow card. But other things,
Ryan, brought can in. Ask you something. See, when you scored, give me one of the goals that you scored. Give me a goal you scored. A good goal, really, really good goal, one that you're really proud of. In a big game.
Yeah, you score a goal in the cup final, don't you? So you score a goal against the Rumblers cup final.
Right, in a really tight game.
Yeah, 1-0 it finished, yeah.
Right, a really tight game. You see, when you've made contact with the ball and you know it's going in, what's the next thing you're feeling here?
The next thing you're feeling here is, well, for mine, was the next thing was getting tackled. That's the next thing I felt, because I got tackled. Because and in the game as well, if it had been a different person who had been playing, then I wouldn't have been allowed the space nor the time to score the goal. And then the next thing you hear is the crowd.
It's the crowd. And that's what I think it's robbing this generation of. Is, for me, there was two things. One, you scored one of those goals, and people that didn't play, even at my level, sometimes I don't know if they don't accept us or don't like it or don't understand it. And sometimes a really tight game where you're, especially when you're supposed to win, there's a relief. Even in that split second, there's a relief that you've gone in front. But the thing that I can remember is the explosion of yourself and the explosion of the fans. Your fans, when that ball hits the net or crawls over the line, that I think the cool kids now call it limbs, when everybody's jumping all over everybody. And when you see these, I've only just came on to social media and these Twitter, when you see some of these the goals that I scored, the explosion from the fans and they're jumping over each other and the noise is incredible. But now I think that gets robbed, because people initially are terrified in the Premier League to celebrate because they wait for the check. They're terrified to be as excited and go crazy like they did before it. And I thought before it came in, I thought they should bring it in, because I thought the technology's there, they should bring it in. But I think we're robbing this generation of that joy of the explosion. And I think it's putting people off, because that's one of the reasons why, you know, I can remember going as a supporter to some games as a youngster. I remember going to see Celtic playing Motherwell at Celtic Park, and Ken Dalglish scored two unbelievable goals. And I can remember, I was in the jungle that day. I think it was one of the first days I was. The jungle, for people that don't know, it was the traditional Celtic part of the ground at Celtic Park. And like when I was small, I don't know what you like, but when I got taken to the Rangers end because it was safer. But when you were in the jungle, it was mental. The jungle was mental. And I was in there, it was one of our first games. And I can remember clear as day jumping around. And then I can remember, you mean, scoring goals for Hearts. And I can remember the fans going amazing, going crazy when you score a goal. And in some of the games, you look at it now and you say, well, I think I might have been offside. And I think fans are terrified now to celebrate and have that hope and that joy taken away from them. That's my. And I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what the answer is because I would really have to think about it to find out what the solution is. But there is a solution because there's always a solution to make something better. How do you make football better? I give you 10 reasons, 10 ways to make it worse and implementing the way 8 of them. But anyway, that's just the rantings of an old boy.
No, but I think that's a very relevant thing, John, because not only you're taking the joy away from everyone. So me scoring that goal in the cup final, you're right, the next thing I feel is a tackle. But as you see the ball getting into the net, and you know that there's no foul involved, you're onside. Is that huge elation of scoring a goal in a cup final at Wembley, the noise then that your own fans make, and the pleasure and the celebration of that moment is one of the greatest things that being part of team sport is, and to take that away, so that you will always get the fans celebrating the players. Well, the players that you say, I think, are becoming more ingrained in this kind of thing of, oh, check, the is it not? And it's very dumbed down.
And
you're going to get that when fans come back again. If you see that before, where there's great joy in the particular game you're talking about, that Champions League game, that was an incredible night for both sets of supporters, whether it was up and down, and that it was very exciting to watch on the television. But you're actually robbing the whole generation of that pleasure. So they might be getting to say, "Well, did you actually? How come you not like?" Maybe they've got children of their own and grandchildren looking back on things that happens. Well, you didn't. Did you not like scoring goals, Grandpa? Well, I didn't know where I scored until half time. And I think it's the same thing, but it's because you played. Is what is it that made? What is it that you enjoyed about playing, scoring goals? What is it about scoring a goal? Was the pleasure and the celebration, the collective celebration, particularly with the support, you know, being able to, a shared moment, you know, between you and them when you know what it is because you were a fan. You know what it's like standing on the other side, but you're actually there having done something that makes you feel really, really happy. And everybody that supports your team sharing in that. A lot of that's just gets skipped past, not even mentioned, not even considered.
I listened to you last week at Ray Mead, and he was talking about the Steve Bruce goals against Sheffield Wednesday. Do you know what I mean? And even I can remember the explosion of joy in Old Trafford on that day. I wasn't there. I was watching it on TV. But it's amazing. And it's those moments for me that make the game of football special and the best game in the world, the best sport in the world. And if we're starting to rob that explosive joy. Anyway, let's talk about something more appropriate for the life of Brian.
Life with Brian. We're going to play another little game here that I'm calling What's the Story, Player or Tory? And this is going to take a little bit of setting up. I had both Chucky and John on another podcast that I do, on which we examine more closely some of the answers behind those old shoot and match player profiles that we talked about earlier from the 1980s. Both of you indicated an interest in politics with a lean in toward the left, which elicited an exchange on John's Twitter.
There's no leaning.
Yeah. And there was an exchange on John's Twitter, which was accompanied by a photo of the pair of you at outside a Labour club doing a bit of campaigning, I believe, somewhere in Ayrshire back in the 80s. And I'm going to put that photo up on our Twitter account, even if just for the knitwear alone. So here's how you're going to play. I'm going to give you three names each, and you have to decide if they are players, current or former, or Tory MPs, current or former. And just to sort of the thread in this is they've all got double-barreled surnames, like I always feel most Tory MPs should have. So, Brian, you won the toss, and you're going to go first this time. So your first person to tell me whether it's a player or Tory is Jeff Wren Adelaide.
Player.
Absolutely. Yeah, he is a player. Good. Was that a guess or did you know?
I can't reveal any of my sources.
Has Matthew been slipping his answers?
I just have got one right. That's it. I'm
on the table.
One right, that'll do me. I can retire now. I can retire from this game. In fact, I'm going to make myself a cup of tea.
Right. Well, Jeff Wren Adelaide, for those that don't know, is a footballer. He plays for Lyon, but he's currently on loan at Nice, and he's a former Arsenal youth player. Right, John, for you to equalise, yours is Jeffrey Clinton Brown.
MP.
Oh, back of the net. Yeah. No, back of the net. Tory MP, the current MP for the Cotswolds constituency. Whether this is a sign of interbreeding or nepotism or what, but he's related to 7 former Tory MPs.
Amazing, huh? Amazing.
Yeah, it's not what you know, but who you know. I think that's proven, isn't it?
Have they all got double barrel names?
Well, I assume most of them were called Clinton Brown, I would imagine. Right, Brian, you're next up to go back in the lead, and yours is Aretas Akers Douglas.
MP.
Ooh, you spawny git. It is that, isn't it? Tory MP from the 1880s to the 1910s. I thought you might get this. The 1880s to the 1910s. Now, I thought you would have thought this one was a player because it's quite a sort of a more modern sounding name, that. But supposedly.
He remembers it, that's why.
The one we just did, his Tory credentials are pretty solid. The second half of his surname was taken apparently as a request in a late relative's will.
Ah, okay.
Right, John, yours is Jake Forster Caskey.
Player.
He is a player. Maybe that was a bit easy. He's currently at Charlton. Yeah, he's currently at Charlton Athletic. And do you know how his surname comes about?
Did his dad play with Tottenham?
Indeed, yeah. His dad is Darren Caskey.
Is Nicky Forster involved in there somewhere?
Absolutely, yeah. His dad's Darren Caskey and his stepdad is Nicky Forster. And both of them played for Reading. So I don't know if they played for Reading at the time he was born or what, but...
I'm glad someone's actually playing this game properly rather than just guessing. You know, it's not... It was.
But to be fair, Brian did that with that last MP as well. He just didn't want to appear too clever.
True. Mm. One of my specialist subjects, you know, Tory MPs from the 1880 to 1910.
Okay. Well, there you go. We'll see you on Celebrity Mastermind in the future, trying to pull a few more out your ass from nowhere then.
Mine's will be the Adventures of Foghorn Leghorn, because that's how far Mastermind has fallen now.
It is, actually. And I get loads of questions right now. They must have fallen badly. In fact, I'm starting to get questions about University Challenge as well. It's just
right, Brian, to get a clean sweep, yours is, this is your final one. It's Ian Liddell-Granger.
MP.
Again, is that one you knew or just a stab in the dark?
Listen, he'll be on his fourth gang of Strongbow. He doesn't know anything.
He is indeed a Tory MP, born in Edinburgh, but he's the MP for Bridgewater and West Somerset. And apparently he's a great-great-great-grandson of Queen Victoria. All right, John, to, you know, at least share the spoils and not to let Chucky get away with just, you know, plucking these out of thin air. Your last one is Ian Thomas Moore.
I'm going on the fact that you see, I don't want to just go your alternate ones. You have 3 and 3. So I'm going to go, but I'm going to stick with that and go as a player because it sounds a proper joined up working class name. So I'm going for player.
Well done. That's it. You're right. It's 3-3. We're not going to go with a tiebreaker, but you're right. But he didn't start out as Ian Thomas Moore. He's a former Tranmere striker, and he's the son of former Tranmere player and manager Ronnie Moore. And he took the Thomas part of his name whilst he was still playing, but after he got married to his long-term partner, and the reason being, so him and his missus and the kids all had the same double-barrel surname. So there we go.
It would be more impressive if Dudley Moore was his dad rather than Ronnie Moore, to be honest.
Although I've seen Tranmere, and to be fair, Dudley Moore could have got a game for them.
And listen, I was on Sunderland's roster when the manager Malcolm Crosby, who's a fantastic fella, and we went down to Tranmere to play the game, and the game was called off, and we'd been through a bad run. But we had to stay the Friday night, obviously, because hotels booked were already down there. So on the Saturday, we're on our way back up the road, and Malcolm got sacked because we got beaten the pools panel. Home win, Tranmere. Malcolm got sacked on the Monday. And we always thought he was the only manager that ever got sacked on a pools panel victory or defeat. A bit harsh because he was a great lad, great coach as well. Just a terrible judge of player because he signed me.
Mucklass mailbag. So let's go straight into the mailbag then. And we've got one here from Ryan Coyle. And this could put you on the spot slightly, this one, Brian, because he says, if you could have taken any of your Celtic teammates to play alongside you at United, which one would it have been and why?
Kevin.
Don't even go there.
Why? Because he would have fitted in perfectly. He had everything that you needed to be a Manchester United player: strength of character, mentality, good player, quick. Loved the club.
Brian once phoned me up when I was at Hearts and I was actually playing well, and he phoned me up and says, "I've got to ask you something." I said, "What's that?" He goes, "The gaffer's asked me to phone you and ask you, have you signed a new contract? This is a true story." And I went, "You bastard." And he went, What? No, he's asking me, because he thought I was slotting him for taking the piss out of me, because, I mean, just teasing me. And he went, but I knew he was being serious, and he went, I signed it 2 weeks ago. We're just keeping it in drawer, announce it sometime in the future. And at that point, you just couldn't get out of them unless, I mean, obviously, as a freebie, I would have been worth consideration, but paying sort of £500,000 to £1 million at the time, I actually wasn't worth it. So that was my one lifeline to playing for Manchester United. That was never really a lifeline.
You obviously would have, you know, it's not it's something you would have, I assume, would have jumped at had Chockey said to you, come down and play.
I would have said no. At the same time, I would have said no to somebody giving me about £10 million at the time, Matt. You know what I mean? That's just not happening. I knew my limitations. You mean that you played and you saw these guys playing when I went to a few international get-togethers and I understood my limitations. And I wasn't that level. I genuinely wasn't that level. But I'm lucky that I found my level, because I don't think it's always about getting to the highest level and not playing, which is kind of what would have happened to me at Old Trafford, I think. But I found my level and played. You know, I played at Hearts for every week for 8 or 9 years, and the first spell I played every week for 6 years, and we had amazing times that I probably wouldn't have enjoyed if I'd went to England earlier. You know, we played Bayern Munich in a quarter-final of UEFA Cup, something that can never be done now, I don't think. Playing away to Atletico Madrid in the European games. I mean, I could name you 50 top players in England that didn't get these experiences and opportunities. And sometimes, and I suppose everybody says, oh, but you're lucky because you've got money, but I actually didn't know my highest wage when I played football was £800 a week. I didn't make any money from football. But sometimes experience is more than the money. For me, and people always say, yeah, you can say that because you've got money, but that's not the case. The case is that the experience of playing for Hearts at Atletico Madrid Bayern Munich at home. We beat Bayern Munich 1-0 at Tynecastle, and that explosion when we scored the goal is something that'll live with me forever. And yeah, I might have had that if I'd gone to a lower English team in the Premiership when I was at the very peak of my career. But I might not have. And nobody can take those memories away from me, which are truly amazing. I mean, we had another shared experience when we went to Old Trafford to play Rapid Vienna in a European Cup winners. It was the UEFA Cup, Brian, or European Cup Winners' Cup? European Cup Winners' Cup it was. Replay. Where the game was replayed falsely and went to Old Trafford. And that is, you know, I've played in Celtic Rangers games, I've played in Hearts Ibs games, Newcastle Sunderland, Millwall West Ham, and nothing was as toxic as I felt that night. That was genuinely, like, because of the wrong that had been brought upon Celtic and the supporters. I don't know if you can remember, but we were going up the, which now the Munich Tunnel, and our bus, and our supporters were rocking our bus from literally almost lifting it off its wheels. And these are experiences and memories that doesn't matter whether you're on 100 grand a week or 700 or 800 quid a week, or as I don't know what you were at the time, Brian. I know exactly what I was on at the time. I was on £380 a week at Celtic. Nobody can ever take them away from me. There's a lot of things you can take away. You can take away your money. They can take away your medals. They can't take away mine because I didn't get any. But what they can't take away is the memories of those. And yeah, I could have went to a bigger club probably, but I wouldn't have had the same memories. And those mean a lot to me.
It's a great point you're talking about there about playing, John, and all the things and the memories. And that's the important things. You've got your memorabilia, you've got whatever else it is, but you've the memories of the things that nobody can take away, nobody can tarnish because they're your memories. But part of the thing about playing is this, right? We played under rules where there were, I think, look, it's fair to say the game was a bit more physical with regards to the attention you got from defenders. The pitches were muddier, to say the least, in worse condition. The kit might have been a little bit heavier, the balls were whatever they were. And we trained every single day, apart from the day after the game, which is usually Sunday. And you had a family, which you had brought up yourselves, no external aids, apart from any other family you'd have to help you out. And you continue to do that and play hundreds and hundreds of games. Why can't footballers do that now?
I don't think it's just footballers, Brian. I think life's changed. I think life's changed. I think the expectations of everyone now is are great, massively heightened. But I agree with you. I'm because I can never mind. I can remember going somewhere and thinking, I'm going to have a moan up about this pitch. You just went and that's what it was, eh? I mean, because everybody thinks, oh, you mean look at Maradona's goals in the 86 World Cup finals, and the pitches are an absolute disgrace. You mean, everybody talks about his close control and him against Messi. And you mean what, you don't have to say who's best, just admire both of them. But you look at Maradona and him being able to control the ball that close at that speed on that pitch is remarkable. But it was just different. I'm not saying it was better or it was worse, but it was definitely different. And I think that as a society, we just got on with things more. Because we weren't aware of a lot of the problems, and there wasn't as much of not a complaining culture, a fact pointing out in culture. I was talking to somebody about somebody complaining, says, He maintains he doesn't complain all the time. He just points out facts, which I think is quite a good way to put it. But we consider ourselves lucky. That's the difference. We consider ourselves lucky to be professional footballers, that someday, at the end of this week, because it was weekly at that time, somebody would put money in your bank for you doing something that you would do for nothing. Because I know this for a fact. If you didn't manage to reach the height you did, you would have played for Airdrie Amateurs or Plains United or somebody like Coatbridge Rovers, somebody like that, as an amateur or a junior, probably a junior. Because if you didn't make it for Man United, I think you could certainly play for Pollock United or somebody like that, Brian. But we would have played because we loved it. I'm not sure that everybody's the same now. I'm just not sure. And I know that we're moaning like a couple of old guys. That's the kind of point of this.
I'm just asking a question about the saying that, or that the players are jaded or the players need a rest or there's not enough time between the games.
I don't know. I think players want to play. Why do players in successful teams not get injured as much as players in teams that are struggling?
I remember you, Brian, watching you and playing on Newsday and then the next day or Boxing Day and the next day, if it fell on a Saturday and what have you. You I know you've spoken about it before, but I mean, I bet you never thought. I bet the thought never crossed your mind that you thought, you've got to play again the next day. I assume you just gone with it.
Yeah, but the thing is that at no point did anybody ever say to you, you need a rest. Now, I know the squads are bigger. I just don't understand why at some point, particularly when you're going to win things. You say, you need to change the team because they're tired. I don't recall being tired. maybe it's just the fact it's been a period of time ago, but I don't remember being tired and thinking, I don't fancy playing because I feel a bit shitty today. I felt shit before every game. I felt tired before every game. I felt crap. If I didn't feel crap, I thought there was something wrong with me. It's just that anytime I felt great before a game, I performed poorly.
Okay, so the final question, and this one's from Andrew McCarron, and he says, we don't hear much of the assistant manager stint at Blackburn Rovers, Brian. What lessons, if any, did you learn from your year at Ewood Park as a number two?
Well, I wasn't the assistant manager, I was first team coach. That was my job title. I think what you learn from when I was there is that going from being a player into the coaching side of the game, that one of the things that for me at the time was I think at Blackburn they would have been a bit spoiled with the patronage of Jack Walker, and I think the main thing was that the players had this ability to phone Jack direct, but I think that was the biggest thing that I found difficult, was that you had the manager, you had chief executive chairman, and then you had Jack Walker, who's the owner. But the players had Jack Walker's mobile phone number and he would take their calls. I found that really difficult to get as a concept, you know.
I assume that was a very unique situation. I mean,
well, I don't know if it was unique or not, but I mean, there was no way that you'd have been there very long under any of the other managers that I had been.
Well, I was going to say, imagine you were ringing Martin Edwards.
I would say that you got the impression that David Hay at Celtic was quite easy going, but I don't think that he would have accepted, and indeed respected any going above him as a player, to be saying that you had opportunity to speak to the chairman or anybody in the board.
That must have compromised your position, surely.
I didn't really have to deal with any of those things. It's just as when you find this out that this is what they were able to do. And it was a fault it was just the way that Jack had allowed to happen.
So do you know whether he'd done that for the whole time that he was owner of the club? I mean, even going back to the Dalglish era when they won the league, I mean, was that something that was just the norm at Blackburn? I mean, it must have been.
Well, I don't know if it was a norm. I just know that the players could speak to the players off and phoned Jack direct, and he would give his view on whether so a lot of it was to do with contractual things, really, you know, not so much about them, whether we're playing or not.
Interesting.
Did it happen anywhere you were, John?
We had a few decent chairmen, but there's absolutely no chairman I can ever remember playing under that I would actually want to phone. Because we just went on the same level as the chairman. And we didn't have that. You mean it was different then. You know, we had a day-to-day relationship with some of them in terms of we saw them, but we were employer's employee, Brian.
Yeah.
That wasn't the relationship that we had. You know, I mean, the vice chairman at Hearts was a guy called Palmer Smith, one of our best friends. And you mean that was slightly different, but that relationship really evolved after I stopped playing.
Yeah.
Although I got on great with him when I played. But you mean there's no way I would have been phoning anybody, chairman or vice chairman, to complain or to sort out any kind of issues. That's just not right. That's a complete, in my opinion, I don't know how Brian Kidd saw it, Brian, it's like showing a complete disdain and disrespect for the manager. Because the manager's place is that he's in charge of the football and the football department.
Right, we're going to wrap it up there. Brian and Matthew, thanks as ever. Hope you've enjoyed it this evening.
As always.
Good. And John, it's been absolutely brilliant having you on.
It's been my pleasure, Mark. I'm sorry I changed the vibe into a slightly more serious football-y vibe. Hope everybody enjoyed it.
All valuable content, John.
A quick mention, as usual, for the Twitter account, which is at Brian McClare Pod. Please drop us a modern day postcard there in the mailbag using the hashtag AskChucky. We are available everywhere in podcast land, although there's been a few hiccups recently with Apple, but I'm sure that'll be resolved pretty soon. So don't forget to subscribe and join us again next time when we'll be joined by another guest. So thanks for tuning in and take care.
Life with Brian, talking films or music. Life with Brian, talking TV and food. Life with Brian, talking trivia and exercise. Life with Brian, it's different every episode. Life with Brian.